Is Audible.
The Invention of Wings by Sue Monk Kidd.
Handful. When they plan to sell you, the first thing they say is, go wash your teeth. That's what Aunt Sister always told us. She said when the slaves got sold on the streets, the white men checked their teeth before anything else. None of us were thinking about teeth after Master Grimke died, though. We thought life would go on in the same old grudgeries. The lawyer showed up to read the will 2 days after Sarah got back from the north. We gathered in the dining room, every one of the Grimke children and every slave. Seemed odd to me why Mrs. wanted us slaves here. We stood in a straight line in the back of the room, half thinking we're part of the family. Sarah was on one side of the table, and Nina on the other. Sarah would look over at her sister with a sad smile, and Nina would glance away. Those two were in a miff. Mrs. had on her nice black mourning dress. I wanted to tell her she needed to take it off and let Mariah launder it because it had gray armpit rings. Seemed like she'd worn it every day since last August, but you couldn't tell her the thing. The woman got worse in her ways by the day. The lawyer, his name was Mr. Hughey, stood up with a handful of papers and said it was the last will and testament of John Forshero Grimke, drawn up last May. He read the wherefores, two wits, and hithermores. It was worse than the Bible. Mrs. didn't get the house. That went to Henry, who wasn't past 18, but at least she could stay in it till she died. I leave her the household furniture, plate, plated ware, a carriage, and two of my horses, the stock of liquors and provisions which shall be on hand at the time of my death. This went on and on, all the goods and chattels. Then he read something that made the hairs on my arms raise. She shall receive any six of my Negroes whom she shall choose, and the rest she will sell or disperse among my children, as she determines. Bennett was standing next to me. I heard her whisper, Lord, no. I looked down the row of slaves. There were just 11 of us now. Rosetta had passed on in her sleep the year before. She shall receive any six. The rest she will sell or disperse. 5 of us were leaving. Minta started to sniffle. Aunt Sister said, hush up. But even her old eyes darted around looking scared. She trained Phoebe too good. Tomfrey was getting on with age too, and Eli's fingers were twisted like tree twigs. Goodis and Sobby were still young, but you don't need 2 slaves in the stable for 2 horses. Prince was strong and worked the yard, but he had glum spells now, sitting and staring and blowing his nose on his shirt. Mariah was a good worker, and I figured she'd stay, but Benna, she moaned under her breath because she was the nursery mama, and there were no more children to rear. I said to myself, Mrs. will need a seamstress, but then I noticed the black dress again. From here on out, all she'd need was a few of those to wear, and she could hire somebody for that. All of a sudden, Sarah said, Father couldn't have meant that. Mrs. shot her a look of venom. Your father wrote the words himself, and we'll honor his wishes. We have no choice. Please allow Mr. Hughey to continue. When he started back reading, Sarah looked at me with the same sorrowful blue eyes she'd had the day she turned 11 years old, and I was standing before her with the lavender ribbon round my neck. The world was abashed in place, and she couldn't fix it. In December, everybody was on their last nerve, waiting for the missus to say who'd go and who'd stay. If I was sold, how would Mama find me if she came back? Every night, I put a hot brick in my bed to keep my feet warm and lay there thinking how Mama was alive, out there somewhere. I wondered if the man who bought her was kind. I wondered if he'd put her in the fields. Was she doing any sewing? Did she have my little brother or sister with her? Was she still wearing the pouch round her neck? I knew she'd get back here if she could. This was where her spirit was, in the tree. This was where I was. Don't let me be the one that has to go. Mrs. didn't have Christmas that year, but she said go ahead and have junkanoo if you want to. That was a custom that got started a few years back, brought by the Jamaica slaves. Tom Free would dress up in a shirt and pants, tatted with strips of bright cloth sewed on, and a stovepipe hat on his head, what we call the rag man. We'd traipse behind him, singing and banging pots, winding to the back door. He'd knock and Mrs. and everybody would come out and watch him dance. Then Mrs. would hand out little gifts to us. Could be a coin or a new candle. Sometimes a scarf or a cob pipe. This was supposed to keep us happy. We didn't expect to feel in a mood this year, but on junkanoo day, here came Tom Free in the yard, wearing his shaggy outfit, and we made a lot of clatter and forgot our troubles for a minute. Mrs. stepped out from the back door in a black dress with a basket of gifts, Sarah, Nina, Henry, and Charles behind her. They were trying to smile at us. Even Henry, who took after his mama, looked like a grinning angel. Tom Free did his jig, twirled, bounced, wagged his arms. The ribbons whirled out, and when he was done, they clapped. And he took off the tall hat and rubbed the crust of gray on his scalp. Reaching in the basket, Mrs. gave the women these nice fans made with painted paper. The men got 2 coins, not 1. The sky had been cast down all day, but now the sun broke free. Mrs. leaned on her gold-tipped cane and squinted at us. She called out Tom Free's name, then Benna, Eli, Prince, Mariah. She said, "I have something extra for you," and handed each one a jar of gargling oil. "You've served me well," she told them. "Tom Free, you will go to John's household. Benna, you will go to Thomas. Eli, I'm sending you to Mary." Then she turned to Prince and Mariah. "I'm sorry to say you must be sold. It's not my wish, but it's necessary." Nobody spoke. The quiet sat on us like a stone you couldn't lift. Mariah dropped down and walked on her knees to Mrs., crying for her to change her mind. Mrs. wiped her eyes. Then she turned and went in the house, followed by her sons, but Sarah and Nina stayed behind, their faces full of pity. "The axe didn't fall on me. Didn't my Lord deliver a handful? The axe didn't fall on Goodis either, and I felt surprise over the relief this caused me. But there was no God in any of it. Nothing but the 4 of them standing there, and Mariah still on her knees. I couldn't bear to look at Tom Free, with the hat squashed under his arm, Prince and Eli studying the ground, Benna holding her paper fan, staring at Phoebe, a daughter she'd never see again. Mrs. doled out their jobs to the ones of us left. Sobby took over Tom Free as the butler. Goodis had the work yard, the stable, and drove the carriage. Phoebe got the laundry, and Minta and I got Eli's cleaning duties. When the first of the year came, Mrs. sent me to work on the English chandelier in the drawing room. She said Eli hadn't shined it proper in 10 years. It had 28 arms with crystal shades and teardrops of cut glass hanging down. Using the ladder and wearing white cotton gloves, I took it apart and laid it out on the table and shined it with ammonia. Then I couldn't figure out how to put the thing back together. I found Sarah in her room, reading a leather book. "We'll figure it out," she said. We hadn't talked much since she got back. She seemed woebegone all the time, always stuck in that same book. After we finally got the chandelier back on the ceiling in 1 piece, tears flared up in her eyes. I said, "You sad about your daddy?" She answered me the strangest way, and I knew what she said was the real hurt she'd brought back with her. I'm 27 years old, handful, and this is my life now. She looked round the room, up at the chandelier, and back at me. This is my life. Right here for the rest of my days. Her voice broke, and she covered her mouth with her hand. She was trapped, same as me, but she was trapped by her mind, by the minds of the people around her, not by the law. At the African church, Mr. VC used to say, "Be careful. You can get enslaved twice, once in your body and once in your mind." I tried to tell her that. I said, "My body might be a slave, but not my mind. For you, it's the other way around." She blinked at me, and the tears came again, shining like cut glass. The day Benna left, I heard Phoebe crying all the way from the kitchen house.
Sarah. 1 February, 1820. Dear Israel, how often I have thought of our conversations on board ship. I read the book you entrusted to me, and my spirit was deeply kindled. There are so many things I wish to ask you. How I wish we were together again. 3 February, 1820. Dear Mr. Morris, after being away from the evils of slavery for 6 months, my mind burst with new horror at seeing it again on my return to Charleston. It was made all the worse upon reading the book you gave me. I have nowhere to turn but you. 10 February, 1820. Dear Mr. Morris, I trust you are well. How is your dear wife, Rebecca? 11 February, 1820. Thank you, sir, for the book. I find a bewildering beauty in your Quaker beliefs. The notion there is a seed of light inside of us, a mysterious inner voice. Would you kindly advise me how this voice... I wrote to him over and over. Letters I couldn't finish. Invariably I would stop mid-sentence. I would lay down the quill, fold the letter, and conceal it with the rest at the back of my desk drawer. It was the middle of the afternoon, the winter gloom hovering as I pulled out the thick bundle, untied the black satin ribbon, and added the letter of February 11 to the heap. Mailing the letters would only bring anguish. I was too drawn to him. Every letter he answered would incite my feelings more. And it would do no good to have him encouraging me toward Quakerdom. The Quakers were a despised sect here, regarded as anomalous, plain-dressed and strange, a tiny cluster of jarringly eccentric people who drew stares on the street. Surely I didn't need to invite that kind of ridicule and shun. And Mother, she would never allow it. Hearing her cane on the pine floor outside, I snatched up the letters and yanked open the drawer, my hands fumbling with panic. The stationery cascaded into my lap and onto the rug. As I stooped to collect it, the door swung open without a knock, and she stood framed in the opening, her eyes moving across my hidden cache. I looked up at her with the black ribbon furling from my fingers. "You're needed in the library," she said. I couldn't detect the slightest curiosity in her about the contents I had spilled. "Sabe is packing your father's books. I need you to oversee that he does it properly." "Packing?" "They will be divided between Thomas and John," she said, and turning, left me. I gathered up the letters, tied them with the ribbon, and slipped them back into the drawer. Why I kept them, I didn't know. It was foolish. When I arrived in the library, Sabi wasn't there. He'd emptied most of the shelves, stacking the books in several large trunks, which sat open on the floor, the same floor where I'd knelt all those years ago when Father forbade me the books. I didn't want to think of it, of that terrible time, of the room stripped now, the books lost to me, always lost. I sank into Father's chair. The clock in the main passage clicked, magnifying, and I felt the shadows gathering inside of me again. Worse this time.
Since returning, I had slipped further into melancholy each day. It was the same trough of darkness I'd fallen into when I was 12, and the life had gone out of everything. Mother had summoned Dr. Gettings back then, and I feared she might do so again. Every day I forced myself to come down for tea. I endured the visitations from her friends. I kept up my attendance at church, at Bible study, at alms meetings. I sat with Mother in the mornings, hoops of embroidery on our laps, willing the needle through the cloth. She'd given me the task of household records, and each week I sorted through the supplies, writing inventories and procurement lists. The house, the slaves, Charleston, Mother, the Presbyterians. They were the woof and warp of everything. Nina had pulled away. She was angry at me for remaining in Philadelphia after Father died. "You don't know what it was like alone here," she'd cried. "Mother instructed me constantly in the error of my ways. Everything from church to slavery to my rebellious nature. It was horrible." I'd been the buffer between her and Mother, and my remaining away for so long had left her exposed. "I'm sorry," I told her. "You only wrote to me once." Her beautiful face was contorted with hurt and resentment. "Once!" It was true. I'd been so enamored with my freedom up there, I hadn't bothered. "I'm sorry," I said again. I knew in time she would forgive the selfish months I'd abandoned her, but I sensed the estrangement came from more than that. At 15, she'd needed to break away, to come out from my shadow, to understand who she was separate from me. My retreat to Philadelphia was only the excuse she needed to declare her independence. As she fled to her room the day of our confrontation, she shouted, "Mother was right. I have no mind of my own, only yours." We passed now like strangers. I let her be, but it added to my despair. I stared at the trunks of books on the library floor, remembering the pangs I'd once had for a profession, for some purpose. The world had been such a beckoning place once. Sabi still had not returned. I got up from my chair and rummaged nostalgically among the books, coming upon the sacred biography of Jeanne d'Arc of France. I couldn't say how many times I'd read that wondrous little volume of St. Joan's bravery before Father had banned me from his library. Opening it now, I gazed at a sketch of her coat of arms. Two fleurs-de-lis. I'd forgotten it was there, and it made sudden sense to me why I'd latched on to the fleur-de-lis button when I was 11. I slipped the book beneath my shawl. That night, unable to sleep, I heard the clock downstairs bong 2, then 3. The rain began soon after, beating without mercy against the piazza and the windows. I climbed from the covers and lit the lantern. I would write to Israel. I would tell him how melancholy swallowed me at times, how I almost felt the grave would be a refuge. I would write yet another letter I wouldn't mail. Perhaps it would relieve me. I pulled open the desk drawer and watched the light tumble inside it. There, as I'd left it, was my Bible and my Blackstone commentary, my stationery, ink, pen, ruler, and sealing wax. Yet I didn't see the bundle of letters. I drew the lamp closer and reached my hand into the empty corners. The black ribbon was there, curled like a malicious afterthought. My letters to Israel were gone. I wanted to scream at her. The need took hold of me with blinding violence, and I flung open my door and rushed down the stairs, clinging to the rail as my feet seemed to sweep out from under me. I battered her door with my fist, then rattled the knob. It was locked. "How dare you take them?" I shrieked. "How dare you? Open the door! Open it!" I couldn't imagine what she'd thought on reading my intimate implorings to a stranger in the North, A Quaker? A man with a wife? Did she think I'd remained in Philadelphia for him? Behind the door, I heard her call to Minta, who slept on the floor near her bed. I pounded again. Open it! You had no right! She didn't respond, but Nina's scared voice came from the stair landing.